understand that one of the courages that poetry can give us is a refusal of the economy that we're taught makes success look like a very, very particular kind of thing. Yeah. And I really go out of my way to, to let my students know that the poetry itself forms the economy you're in, and that's an ancient Greek word, an oikonomos, like just the laws, the habits, how it is in the house it is that you are, like poems are also kind of ethical and economic creatures, and there's as important lessons in like how poetry teaches us to value.
Hi everyone, welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor of the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing. And today we are overjoyed, if I can say that.
Yes, you can.
Thank you, Stephen. To have with us poet, translator, prose writer, novelist, teacher of teachers, the incomparable Dan Beachy Quick. Dan is the author of 6 books of poetry, North True, South Bright, Spell, Mulberry, This Nest, Swift, Passerine, and Circles Apprentice, winner of the Colorado Book Award for Poetry and Gentleness. He is also the author of a book of interlinked meditations on Herman Melville's Moby Dick, titled A Whaler's Dictionary, and a collection of essays, meditations, and fairy tales, Wonderful Investigations, a study on John Keats, A Brighter Word Than Bright, Keats at Work, and a collection of essays, fragments, and poems of silence and song. Recently, Dan has translated the work of Greek philosophers and Greek lyric poets in the books The Thinking Root and Stone Garland, and he even released a book of Sappho translations entitled Wild Mountain Oak. Dan is a poet and writer who deeply understands the beauty of language, setting on the page critical thought and heart and the urgency of living, even as his work often shifts its gaze away from the self, to the past, to nature, to the thoughts of other thinkers, tinkering with themselves and the letters around the world that give meaning to speech. I often hear people say, not to meet your heroes. I'm lucky and grateful to have met and to know Dan, a kind, creative, invested artist who has held up a lantern and shown so many of us a way to move forward in this world. It is a huge privilege to welcome to the show Dan Beachy Quick. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Danny. Thanks, everyone.
Welcome.
Now I'm all choked up.
It's good. That's what we do here. We just weep for about an hour and then
start off emotional.
Yeah, yep.
It sounded like one of those awards he won was for Something and Gentleness, but Gentleness was the title of a collection, is that right?
I made up a word for a title, gentlessness.
Oh, nice.
Did I say it wrong?
I probably heard it wrong. Yeah. I probably heard it wrong.
My wife told me not to do that, but I I thought it was such a great idea.
It's gentlessness?
Yeah, I had this idea that was like the poet's condition to be gently without gentleness, or I don't know. It's awkward. Yeah.
No, I like it.
I'm here for it.
Gentleness.
I've been saying a word for decades that I thought was real, like in meetings with the dean and president. I've been saying the word cohegent, and I looked it up, and it's not real.
Like cohesive and cogent all at once? That's a beautiful
That's
word.
It. Yeah. That's right, and it doesn't exist.
No, it
does. I got spell checked. On my performance review.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife invented the word egreged, which is like
egreged,
but in an egregious way.
I kind of like that.
Yeah, that's beautiful too.
You guys are making me feel a lot better for having really messed up.
Danny, if you hadn't pronounced it like that, this subject would never have come up.
Danny, was it you forgot how to spell professor when you were writing it on the board?
I certainly probably have.
Who was it who was about to write the second F and looked over and a student was like, no.
Well, Lauren, I mean, we're on the podcast. I was
not in front.
Well, that was that was the character Ross from the TV show Friends.
Oh, is that?
That's what you're thinking about.
Oh my, we're very far away from.
Did you tell me that story?
I did tell you that story.
God. Yep. Dan, you were here yesterday. Visited a class. You gave a reading. It was amazing. At one point, I feel like you were reciting from memory the beginning or the intro of a poem. What were you doing before Orpheus, before you looked down at the paper? Were you just saying that off the top of your head?
I don't know. I have no memory of this.
Do you remember what I'm talking
about? Yeah, you told the audience the story of Orpheus going back to get his wife.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was just being extemporaneous.
Okay, that's...
Yeah. But I remember it. Somehow it came out rhyming, and that was a little bit strange. Yeah, that was an accident.
So, basically, we wanted to have you here on Sad Me of the Past to talk about your current writing, but also the beginning of your writing career, to go all the way back to the smaller version of you, to the little Dan that decided to start writing, and sort of just see where you were, where you came from, and then where you're at now. First, I think we usually like to just get a quick setup of when you first started writing, where you were living, what grade you were in, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was in high school that I like really began, you know, trying to write poems pretty regularly. In part because I had this rare kind of creature, a high school teacher that actually could teach poetry and loved it. She had taken courses, a woman named Becky Porter. You know, I had I was a real screw up in middle school. Like, I was a disaster. I failed homeroom. Like, I was that kind of student that, like, a teacher called, my homeroom teacher, I don't even know, called and said I made his life a living hell. I was, like, what? Just rambunctious, like, failing things. And I went into high school, like, selling uppers. I mean, I was, like, this kid headed towards military school, which I was threatened with by my mother, like, all the time. And I was doing very poorly in ninth grade. And the one teacher I liked, I remember, you know, like I was that kid just because my instinct was to be a jerk. You know, you'd call my name and I wouldn't say I was there. And so this teacher called my name and thought I was absent. And this is when I knew I had to change something in my life. And the teacher said, you know what happiness is? Going to the grocery store and seeing Danny Quick's face on a milk carton.
God, wait. I don't think that'd fly these days.
Whoa.
And it just like, I was like, oh my God, the one.
Was she reported?
The one teacher I like, hopes I would get kidnapped.
Do you think she said that because you didn't announce yourself that you were there? Like, do you think she didn't know you were there and said that?
I think she didn't know I was there and let her feelings out.
What if she thought maybe she really admired you and thought you'd start your own, like, dairy company?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thought, but I feel like maybe that wasn't the actual gist of the comment.
Wow.
At any rate, it, like, woke something up in me, and I decided I was going to be serious about school. I just realized, like, all my teachers thought I was an idiot. Like, I didn't feel especially smart, but I knew I wasn't that dumb. And so, you know, English was the thing that I felt like I could do. It was, like, a place I felt a lot of pride, and I became, you know, by my like sophomore or junior year, like from that very obnoxious young Danny Quick to like an obnoxious in a very different way Dan Quick, who thought I knew a ton about you know, I was like, thought I was so smart, like I knew how to read poems, you know, and Becky Porter put us into a group to do Shakespeare. We had to interpret Shakespeare's sonnet 173, that time of year thou mayest in me behold. And it was like group work, and I took over the group and was just an arrogant jerk, and did the whole presentation myself about what this poem meant. And in front of the entire class, Becky Porter asked if I'd even read the poem.
Wow. And
what was the answer? Had you?
Apparently, what I thought was reading wasn't reading.
Oh, no. Becky Porter.
But it was like the largest gift. Like, yeah. Like so strange. Like, this kind of public humiliation, like, actually humbled me in a way where I realized something that I'd never forgotten, that the poem is something smarter by large degrees than I am. And I had to, like, learn how to become a student to it. I had to, like, not force my will on the poem. I had to learn how to be a student of it, be in service to it in a way. And it's like from that point on, like I don't know, something in me like really, really shifted. And it's right around then that I started reading poems and trying to write them. You know, I started seeing Christy that year, who was in that class. And I like this other moment happened, like that was really significant, where Becky Porter took us through John Donne's A Valediction Forbidding Mourning. And like iota by iota, line by line, like took us through like the utmost accuracy of that poem, you know, ending with that great image of the compass that grows erect as it comes back home and draws the circle just. And it's like I had this realization that the difficulty of poetry isn't that its abstraction is abstract, it's that its abstraction is distilled. It's like a form of utmost kind of accuracy. And then all I wanted in my life was to write a poem. It's like, oh, wow. Poems can do that. And it just like did a thing to me. And so 30 odd years later, I'm still just like trying to write a poem.
So poetry was your version of military school.
Yes.
I was going to say, sounded like you took over that group. You made the presentation. It sounds like you could have gone on to be like a corporate titan, but you just like went the other way into poetry. And so I'm curious, I have to ask who Christy is. Maybe I'm supposed to know that.
Christy's my wife.
That's amazing. Yeah. I was hoping that was true. That's incredible.
Yeah, Christy and I started seeing each other in high school.
Wow.
Did you write her a poem?
Oh yeah, of course I did. Yeah.
what a transformation.
Yeah.
Also, I was curious, what made you, when you said you were confident in English, when you decided to make that shift and like be a good student, what was it about English that you were confident in? Had you had a background? Had you been a reader earlier than that? Or had you, like, why was it English and not, like, physics or something?
Yeah. Well, it was English because I'd always loved, okay. I mean, I was a, you know, voracious reader all throughout my childhood and played around with words and played Scrabble nonstop with my grandparents. You know, it's like language and words and letters were a thing I felt very comfortable with.
And Dan, to jump off of that then, so you were reading as a child. In those years when you were feeling a little bit more, I think the word you used was rambunctious, were you reading through junior high during that time when things felt a little bit less, stable in your sort of academic life? Were you still going home and reading? Were you connecting to language through other things like music? I'm just trying to sort of get a sense of how else you were kind of connected to art as a junior high and high school student.
Yeah, I mean, junior high was a kind of dark ages in my my life. But I do remember reading. But I was just reading like junky, trashy, like adventure novels, like Clive Cussler and Raise the Titanic and things. I would just stay up all night reading these things. I think the character's name was Dirk Pitt. I'm not sure that's true, but I just remember like saying that to
That'd
myself.
That'd be a great pseudonym for...
Sounds like the right read for rambunctious middle school guy.
Oh, I read the submarine novel, the Red...
Oh, Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, I read those kinds of things.
They were fairly evolved literary thrillers, though. At least Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
And for folks who don't know, so you grew up where? Where was all this happening?
Lakewood, Colorado. Outside of Denver, yeah. Alameda Junior High, leveled to the ground, softball field now, and then Alameda High School.
The Alameda What was the...
Pirates.
The Pirates, all right.
Yeah, Silver and Blue.
Silver and Blue. All of this is very pertinent to where we're headed.
Yeah,
for sure. We're trying to picture where exactly you were and what exactly you were doing when you wrote the piece that you're going to read.
Well, I think something that then I'll kind of jump in on that was, so you're starting to write, you're taking this class, you've met what will turn out to be the love of your life.
Yeah.
And when you start writing, do you remember at that stage, and I know we're going to talk a little about some of your college work, were you someone who, were you writing longhand in a notebook? Were you writing under the cover of darkness? Were you outside in the mountains of Colorado writing amongst nature? How did you start kind of this process?
Yeah, I would make my own journals, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, and I would make a little collage for the front of it and lined paper, and I would write, yeah, everything by hand with this like kind of strange nervous tic, like, which I think has like deeply impacted the way I still write poems. Like I'd write a line and then I would just cross out that line and write almost the exact same line over and cross it out, like until the line felt like inevitable. And then I would go to the next line. So it was never like a poet who like sat down and just wrote a poem. I like wrote a line and crossed it off like hundreds and hundreds of times. And so a lot of those early journals, which are somewhere in the house, in the crawl space, I think like the pages are just scribbles, like lines scribbled out. They look like some strange Cy Twombly experiment or something.
You were like strength testing each line.
Yeah.
It had to make it through several markouts.
It had to feel in a certain way to me before I could write a next line. And I think I'm still that way.
Do you think, did you actually make the journals? Like, do you made the paper or like, how
no,
did you? Okay.
I bought a folder those kind of wonderful ones that came apart and you could put like 100 pages in and
with like the clasps.
Yeah, with those little brass clasps. Yeah,
okay.
Which I loved. And they had all these different great colors and they were kind of modeled and yeah, I really loved making those.
Well, it is interesting to think about crossing out. I know that there's a lot of writers that I've spoken to that have taken to other modes of writing, things like a typewriter, where it's harder to cross out. Versus, a keyboard where you can write and then immediately delete it. When you write now, do you still write longhand?
No. My handwriting, like, looks like I could write myself my own prescriptions. It's so bad. It's like slower now to write. So now I just type on my computer. It's much less romantic, but far more efficient. but it's still, like, a good, like, when I'm writing poems, like a good writing day is like four lines for me. Like I'm still like, it has to feel like the next line is somehow fated to emerge from the line before it. It's like this very strange, very slow process.
So do you have an editing process then, or do you think you're editing as you write?
I think the editing is built into the process. I like simply don't write a line until I feel like that line is supposed to be there. So, like, I'm a vacuum of advice for revision because it's just not part of my process in any real significant kind of way. Like, I can't write the next line until that line feels there to be written.
It's dual action.
Or it's like pre-revision or something. That's kind of amazing. I mean, I know fiction writers who write like that. I think Kevin Brockmeyer says that he writes like that, where no sentence happens until the previous one is just perfectly solid. But it seems like a very tough way to write, but also if it's your way to write, it's what works, I guess. Yeah.
I like the patience of it. I do write all the Greek out by hand, though.
Oh my gosh.
So your handwriting's better in Greek?
Yeah, oddly.
Because it's slower?
Yeah, because I have to be so deliberate about it. You have to think about the letters in a way. And so, yeah, I have these lined notebooks and I write a line of Greek and then I put four spaces in between and write the next line, and then I translate in between those.
Oh, wow.
Dan, I have to admit that when I was a teenager, I thought it would be just the coolest thing to know Greek, to learn Greek, but all I did was write English words with Greek letters, which is not exactly how it works. So it's not at all. And so I'm continually impressed with the fact that you know Greek. Who does that?
I don't know it, but, you know, in a dilettante amateur kind of way, I can make my way through. It's slow. It takes, like, in an hour, I can translate 6 to 8 lines of poetry. It's just, it's super slow work.
I want to make sure we get to talk to you about translation in that process. I also want to see what's in this folder in front of you.
Yeah, for sure.
So before we have you read some of this, you were giving us this great account of sort of coming up through high school. You had had this one teacher, and at this point, you had been working on your academics, so you knew you wanted to go to college. And so you end up where?
At Hamilton College in upstate New York. because they you could concentrate in creative writing there. That's why I chose it. I went from being, you know, a student who failed homeroom to kind of monomaniacally invested in writing poetry. It's a real curious turn, the opposite side of the same fact. Yeah, it was ridiculous. So I went there to study writing, only to find out that, like, when I went to meet with my advisor, he looked at me very quizzically and kind of laughed and then said that he thought that I was a practical joke by another student named Danny Quick, who had just graduated from Hamilton College.
You as wow. a person were a living joke.
Yeah, it was like, it was so strange. Yeah, I showed up and he thought, oh, I didn't think you were a real student. I thought you were, like, I thought this other Danny Quick who graduated last year, who I worked with, put in another application just as a practical joke, which was like an odd way to begin.
Yeah. School.
And then I, like, you know, I'd always gotten A's in math after I started studying math, and my test came back that I was in serious need of tutoring in order to continue. Like a lot of certain, like, starting college, all I am saying is it was a weird kind of moment where certain senses of myself were a little bit iffy, compounded by the fact that I learned as I registered for classes that they wouldn't let any first-year students take creative writing, and that felt really punishing.
That is punishing
to me. And so I kind of went through my first semester and we're getting ready to register for the second. And the poet there at the time was this lovely Kashmiri man, Agha Shahid Ali. And I, like, wanted to ask if he would do an independent study with me. Someone told me that there's such things as independent mm-hmm. studies. And the English department was in this house on the kind of main quad up the hill, and I walked up, and it's like in the attic of the room, and he asked my name, and I think I said, I'm Danny Quick, and he said, quick, quick goes the starling. Do you know that poem? It's like, no, I still don't know that poem. I don't even know that that is a poem. But anyway, out of, like, the mercy of his heart, you know, he, like, said, of course, I'll do that, and you know, I came every week, and he'd give me these assignments, double sonnets, sestinas, a dream poem. I'd bring them, and he'd bring out these three different colored pens, red, green, and purple. And with red, he would just, like, it was so intense for me. It was like, cross off, rearrange. Like, I'd bring him a poem, and he would, like, two lines would survive what, you know, I had given him. And then the green would underline things that he felt were going good. And then in purple, he would write all the books I was to go to the library and read. And he would just send me off. And at the end of the year, I knew I was going to transfer back to Colorado and go to University of Denver. And, you know, as a freshman, I was, you know, like an awkward poet kid, you know, who wanted to play soccer more than I was able to play soccer, because I felt like becoming a student and I couldn't go out for the soccer team. That's my only regret, not playing soccer in college. You know, he, like, invited me to his house where he was cooking a meal for all his, like, seniors who were going away, and I just showed up early because I thought you were supposed to be early. He was still cooking. He looked at me, you know, with this, like, the way you look at a sad dog that doesn't know what to do.
No, I bet he sat me on his porch. Thrilled. He was probably thrilled.
Gave me a poems. Gave me a beer, like, when, you know, and I just sat there, and everyone showed up, and that was, like, you know, I didn't see him for years. And then he came out to University of Denver when I was there, and I saw him, and I don't know. He was a very large figure for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these poems, I believe, are what I turned into him at the end of that independent study. So,
so good.
Poems is titled A Collection of Themes.
Nice.
Yeah. 11 poems written between January 19th, 1993 and May 2nd, 93.
Wow. Yeah. I like the specificity.
It's the librarians are going to be,
yeah.
Your archivists
yeah,
are going to be.
Thinking about my,
there you go.
Sadly, this is the only significantly dated. I've gotten much less,
and
precious
one,
about it.
One other thing before we jump in, because Dan, you and I were talking a little bit about this yesterday. The cover says the title, it says the 11 poems, and then it says by DJ Quick.
Yeah.
So at this time, also, you're in a new space. You're sort of coming into your own, and it appears that you're also sort of thinking about what's in a name and sort of like what your name will be.
Yeah. I think I had a feeling that for whatever reason, Danny Quick was not a name by which one could become a poet.
Did it have anything to do with the other Dan Quick? Like, because he's out there somewhere, right? I mean,
I would love to know what happened to that Dan Quick. That's so eerie. I'd forgotten that that happened, but.
What if we had him right here? What if he just walked right into the room?
Behind this curtain.
That would be the most amazing podcast ever. Yeah, I wonder what that Danny Quick is up to. He's 4 years older than me. That's all I know.
Right. Yeah, that's all we know. Okay.
And so, you know, I was like, you know, thinking about like T.S. Eliot. And Shahid was a T.S. Eliot scholar. That's what he was. And I was like, you know, maybe I should try that. So I tried DJ Quick, I think only for these poems. And I don't think the poems in there are titled, you know, it's like they just think they say Dan Quick. Yeah.
Wow. Back in that period, were there people who called themselves like DJ whoever, DJ this, you know?
Yeah, musicians? There was a rapper named DJ Quick, which also was kind of, I remember.
Dan, you're replicated all over the world.
Yeah. Who went to jail, actually. I remember a headline saying DJ Quick.
Maybe that was one of your hyper realities.
Maybe. I like that as a hyper reality. Yeah. I like that quantum.
Quantum
yeah, there's a real entanglement of DJ Dan Quick set that I've never thought about it, but yeah, it's kind of eerie. It is. Yes.
Poetry set you straight.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Was this before?
Solidified me.
This was before you took Beachy.
Yeah. Because
Dan Beachy Quick is like a poem in itself, right? As a name. I'm going to.
It's a nice
I'm gonna
name.
Say.
Yeah.
It's a great name.
It's a great name.
Well, maybe.
It's like a single line poem. Yeah. Dan Beachy Quick.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about, I mean, one question I'm always curious about is where you like to do your writing. And it may not be, you know, were you a kind of, I write in my room kind of person? Did you like to write out in the world? Did you have any particular environment that you preferred to be in when you were working? Like where can we picture you writing these poems?
Yeah.
Somewhere at Hamilton on campus?
Well, I think the ones on campus, I probably just wrote in my dorm room, save some. Actually, like, I took Russian in high school. I don't remember much of it, but I can still read the letters, like your relationship to Greek. And then at Hamilton, I just thought I would study Swahili. I had a weird logic about things. And the Swahili was taught by students who were from Kenya. And so there was a group of women from Africa who lived on campus, all like on a house on the edge of campus all together. And they kind of took me under their wing. So a lot of these poems were like they would invite me over for dinner and meal, and they'd study and I'd stay in their place and work on these poems.
Wow.
I can picture all of this, but it's like animated, right? It's like an animated movie.
To me, it's not animated, but it's in a like a magical forest.
Yeah.
I see you sort of walking down, and then this house sort of coming out.
There was an amazing woods with paths through it at Hamilton, but I don't think I had to walk through them to get to the house. And then I would, you know, trudge through the winter back to my solitary dorm room, and yeah.
And were you a cartoon rabbit or no?
In my heart.
All right. See, I'm picturing it correctly.
A little one. I'm a younger and younger rabbit as I get older and older in my human form.
Do you want
to read
one of or two of or yeah. some of these poems.
Would be wonderful.
Well, I'll let you guys pick which one. I mean, look at this.
Oh my gosh.
Look at it. Oh, wow.
There's a letter.
Yeah, that's Shahid who wanted me to send him something and I never did.
Seems oh, that's so. Like a self-addressed envelope.
Yeah.
Oh. We'll see.
So strange. I don't know. And here's a poem Shahid gave me of his. We should read that, maybe a ghazal.
We could read
wow.
that too.
Yeah. Should I just open at random?
Let's see. Let me look.
Yeah, look in here.
Lauren is, for those of you who can't see.
I mostly just wanted to touch it.
Lauren is flipping through the pages.
I feel like winter. It's a shorter
Ooh.
One, right?
Winter, it looks like it's shorter, yeah.
And it's the first one.
Okay, so I was probably pretty proud of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Oh, let's travel. Okay.
All right. Winter. The snow gathers in hollow treads that inch across the fields and stop with the tractor stalled for the season among the cut-off corn stalks. The snow gathers on the tractor, too, freezing the light blue motor so it won't kick over in spring when the farmer will curse and kick the gently thawing tires.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's not bad at all.
As someone who went to college in a rural environment at a small school, that just strikes me as something that you would see, but I would not have seen it like that.
Can you immediately think of what you were reading? I mean, it's so sort of imagistic and
yeah.
so focused on, like, sounds like Williams, right?
Yeah, well, and Shahid was Hayden Carruth, I think, was someone I was having to read right then. James Merrill was someone that he really sent me to. Charles Wright, he
Charles
sent
Wright.
Me to. Yeah, who I remember being so important to you, Lauren.
Oh, I loved him.
Yeah.
I love him forever. Yes,
yeah.
He was my first favorite poet.
Yeah, yeah.
I found his thesis here in the library when I was a freshman, and I wrote him and said I'd read his thesis. And he was so kind about it, but he was like, please don't tell anyone my thesis.
He read my first year in the workshop. He came and read in Van Allen.
Yeah,
he
was fantastic.
Yeah.
I never heard him read. I would have loved to. You know, so I was obviously, like, very, very image-heavy, like, imbued with that kind of rural thing. But that rural thing was everywhere around upstate New York. Like, I'm sure I did kind of, like, see this and thought, oh, this is, you know, worthy of a poem.
But it already sounds like you. Like, I don't know. What's your favorite letter? Mine's R.
Yeah, R's are great.
Aren't they?
Oh, my favorite letter is A.
Okay.
Yeah, which is also kind of my favorite word. I like the economy.
there's so many, like, your work has, like, R's and LKs and, you know, like, it's already in here, these sounds that I sort of associate with you. And even the translations, I feel like there's these echoes of the alphabet in there.
Yeah. You know, like, I don't know. Like, it feels so, like, precious to me, gently thawing tires. That's, like, that should not be written. But, you know, I can hear something of, like, the music that, like, guides me in poetry with, the off-rhyme of tractor to motor to kick over. Like, that kick over, that's a moment. That's solid.
Word,
yeah, kick over. Kick over. I'm okay with that.
How does it feel? You were saying yesterday you haven't read these.
No, I was scared, though I did look at this first one, but, like, I don't know. There's others. I feel like there's a lot of crows. That's a Sestina, I fear.
I mean, I would love to hear another one,
but
there's the first one was magnificent. I love that that it sort of goes ahead and thinks about the farmer in the spring, sort of goes forward in time, and, you know, there's sort of a human exploration there.
Yeah.
And I think for college age, I think gently thawing tires is restrained. I mean, I think for, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
Bad image, it's so gently bad.
No, it's wonderful.
But I do think it's really interesting, something I've always valued in your work, Dan, is the ability to look at the world instead of only the self. And I'm not knocking, pardon me, other writers. But I like that even in this first poem, it, through its images, you're speaking about existence without ever really bringing up the I or the self. Is that something that you had, that you were aware of? Or is that something you even think about now?
Well, you know, I mean, I do note that, like, it does seem, you know, rather strange to me that I don't, like, in the first poem I would put in, like, these 19, you know, this 19-year-old poet turning these in, that I never say I in that poem. Yeah. Does somehow feel kind of forecasting of the poet it is that I would become. I mean, I've like struggled throughout the years of my writing with what that first person pronoun is actually doing in a poem, what kind of authority actually clings to it, what kind of authority it's trying to claim, and if it's actually capable of claiming it. And there's something very sweet to like see this first poem from a 19-year-old version of me where, you know, the nature of the vision doesn't, you know, hardly requires an eye to do anything other than kind of have witnessed it. And the potency of the scene isn't what I recognize about it, but just that the scene is there to be recognized by someone who happens to be there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like an awareness that it's more than a singular viewer or witness. It's
It conjures the person, right? The person isn't being viewed. That's someone who appears in the poem, and the imagination, the image of him not being able to get the tractor started in the spring is something that, you know, it's not like he's in the scene. You've invented him and brought him into the poem. So there's also like another human being and another consciousness that, you know, beyond the self. It's not just not you. It's another person too, yeah. Sort of in there.
Yeah. It is peopled in a way, but it is kind of interesting that the, you know, the one who would be the speaker somehow is simply a kind of bundle of nerves that's observing and imagining in a particular kind of way and making no claim for himself in the world of the poem other than being a witness to it. Yeah.
It thrills us to see obsessions or lines of thought that go through from your young writing all the way to today. And a lot of times we find that authors have spent their whole lives trying to describe something or tell something or do something. Do you see any of that in there?
You know, I see. I mean, this question about the nature of the self in relation to lyric practice is an ongoing kind of concern to me. Like, still something I think very hard about, you know, often to my own bewilderment and the bewilderment of my students in a way. And that's not only what it is to say I in a poem. It's like how to be a particular self in the world who teaches poems and reads them. All of it feels, you know, kind of terrifyingly interconnected to me. But there's an aspect, like, there's, like, what surprises me about reading this is there's, I mean, there's a formal precision to the couplets that, you know, it's like to see that I'm, like, worried about the logics of form very early on is curious to me. And there's, like this undercurrent of musicality that, you know, there's a music that's thinking there. There's a set of rhymes that is really what, you know, if there's any redeeming virtue in this poem, it's that there's a sonic intelligence underneath it, and I didn't think I had an ear. I didn't think I was paying attention to the music of poetry until much later. Not until like I got here and was doing graduate school in some way. I thought Hopkins like tuned me to that in a way, and I had not read any of those writers that made me think about music as a primary intelligence in a poem at that point, but I can hear that my ear is trying to teach me how to write here, even though it's like so hypervigilant in terms of what it's trying to see. Like that's like the gift of this poem, you know, like to come back to it 31 years later. It's like, I thought writing this, I must have, that like the power of the poem was in the precision of the image, but actually like what the poetry is trying to teach me is that the highest intelligence of the poem is in its music.
I have a thought, and it's going to be, just bear with me. Okay, so can we agree that like that human consciousness on a grand scale evolves, right? So the consciousness of the Greek poets was different than our consciousness today?
I don't know.
Do you mean like individual Greek poets or like...
I mean like as a whole,
a collective,
the human...
A collective, okay.
Yeah, the human consciousness was different.
Know. Big question.
Well, I'm going to posit it. So when you are... When you're translating from that work, you're basically kind of melding your mind into a different type of consciousness, right?
What feels apprehendable to me in that is that I do think each language thinks in the way that language thinks. And to put yourself within a language is to complicate the way that your mother tongue has taught you to mm-hmm. think. And it does feel to me that ancient Greek thinks in a very different way, like almost a fundamentally different way than English has taught me to think. And, you know, that's one of the things I feel here is how, like, syntactically staid this poem is. Like, it's like unquestioning faith in subject, verb, object as exactly the way it is that... Desire is supposed to perform itself in the knowledge-making work that language does. And one of the things where we're like, I'm not sure like there's an evolution just because that implies a particular kind of progress. And there are ways in which how I've come to think about like what ancient Greek does, that mind, you know, the ancient Greek mind is in the world in a far more profoundly entangled way. Than English has ever allowed me to be in it. You know, it's like how language adheres, how word adheres to world, how they're enfolded in one another. When you like skip past the mere thought that language is there to kind of represent in an identifiable way the things it is that it names, but when you kind of hazard a particular faith in what language can be, that how we describe the world is part and parcel of what the world might actually be, then the ethos of what a lyric practice is like as profound a responsibility as you can have. Like you're teaching yourself to think in the world, and how you think in the world reveals what the world might be.
What the world is.
Yeah, absolutely. And Greek has helped with that. Like I feel a very naive mind in here that doesn't know how to ask the questions that poetry is actually teaching this poet to ask eventually.
What if you translated that poem into Greek?
The direction from English to Greek is a little bit past my self-taught amateur pay grade. Yeah. Well,
I mean, I have a question, which is, and maybe this would be obvious to you and to any poet, but what would be the questions that if you were writing this poem now that you would be asking that you weren't then? Would they be just questions about that relationship between language and the world and more sort of... anxiety about sort of the reliability of the connection, or you know, what would that be?
Wow, what would I think about this poem? You know, I think I would kind of I would sense that what the poem is most wanting to attend to is the cosmological shift from winter into spring. Like it's a poem of kind of, you know, it's an eclogue in its way, though I didn't even think I knew exactly what an eclogue was then. It's tied into the pastoral, but the kind of staidness, the ease, like its assuredness about its image doing the work that I know it's doing. Like I can feel like the weird 19-year-old pride of making a kind of perfect seeming little lyric poem. Like the poet in me now would really want to find ways to mess that up, you know, like, yeah. Like the a poem that actually suffers the condition that it names, like what it is to thaw, what it is to kind of lose, like to go from a kind of formal staid compactness that winter and its kind of freezingness might allow. Like for a poem to like think about thaw, it has to itself enact that thawing within its own formal nature. So there's something in here that actually it's merely painting a picture. It's not enacting the kind of logic that's dearest to it. Because it's like it doesn't know how. Like it took me 30 years to even think in such kinds of ways. So in that way, like to me now, this is like a wholly failed kind of poem. It's like it's a cute postcard to send your family, which I probably did, you know. But there is, like, the things that will teach me what I come to learn about, you know, how I think about poetry. You know, like, that's there. It's, like, there in the music. It's there in, like, the internal rhymes. It's there in, you know, like, what I would say is, like, the softer O of tractor that then moves to harder and harder O's as the poem goes along should actually likely be reversed.
Right.
You know, like, the sonic should gain a softness as it moves forward in time through itself. So there's things here.
I mean,
I learned from.
You needed this poem, obviously, in order to get to now.
Maybe. I like to think that that's true. I do think that's true. I mean, I do think, like, you know, and I teach this to my students, I think it's very true. Like, in the end, the only teacher you have are the poems that you write. And that's like a very bitter, sweet, sweet, bitter irony, you know, like, it's not that the need for a teacher in any one of our lives ever particularly stops, and I think it just increases in some way, but it increases with this kind of bitter twist that the only teacher in the end you have is the poem that you write, and how to kind of write humbly enough to learn from the poem, which has to be its own intelligence. Because it has to have its own language, you know. It's like the poem's language is its own in a way, and like you can't go through your daily life speaking as the poem speaks. Like it would be, I think, a disaster in all kinds of ways, from the pragmatic to the spiritual. It's curious to see that even back then these poems are like trying to teach me something.
Well, Dan, so you leave the university after you write these poems. And you go back to Denver, when you're talking about sort of learning from the self and the only teacher you really have are the poems, when you get back to Denver, are you at that point studying more creative writing? Are you still writing at that point? Are you reading? Who, besides your own writing, were there writers that you started to gravitate to and learn from? I know something that I missed out on a lot, both in high school and through even early parts of college. I never really had a strong understanding of what the world of, I'll sort of use air quotes here, contemporary poetry was. It took me a long time to start to realize what was going on in that space, and that there was a world where people would want to read and engage with art and literature in that way.
Yeah.
So who were you sort of, by the time you got back to Denver, were you studying with folks? Did you meet a community of writers? Were you just reading as much as you could get your hands on? What was that, Dan, sort of going through?
Yeah. So I ended up transferring to the University of Denver and, you know, very fortuitously, though, again, like, as I think is very typical with me, like, very little plan that somehow works out better than than I could plan it. And, you know, DU had, though I didn't know it, like, an astonishingly good master's and PhD program and a great literary journal. And, you know, within that first year, they were on trimesters. So, you know, like, by the middle of that second 10-week period, I'd been taking classes. Like, I wasn't reading a lot of contemporary poems. I think I came back with James Merrill's, you know, selected work with me that Shahid had sent me off with. And I was not by any means yet a really serious reader. I was reading a lot of E. Cummings. Like, there were like places that I would like kind of delve into, but nothing had kind of like gelled into like a deliberate practice of studying poetry to the point of love that, you know, I think it in some ways has to become. And little things like really like made a big difference, like Survey Brit Lit 1, taught by Eleanor McNeice, who I thought had like the heart of a hummingbird. She was so fast with everything that she did. And, you know, it's like, that's the first time I read Keats. Didn't understand it. We're reading Shakespeare. Didn't really understand it, but I was starting to get something of, like, the granular imprint of mind and soul and heart that happens in a great poet. Like, I could feel that these poets were alike but different. Like, I sensed something was happening. Hopkins kind of woke me up in really large sorts of ways. Dickinson was starting to whisper in my ear, though like a real kind of, like what felt almost like a conversion experience with Dickinson was still some years ahead of me. It's like I was just like beginning to kind of be able to adjust the light by which you can see the poems. Like I wasn't a great reader yet. I didn't know how to do that work in a way that wasn't just exerting my own intelligence upon the intelligence of the poem. I didn't know how to surrender to it yet. Like, you don't get taught these kinds of things. You have to write your way into it in some kind of way. You have to endure to the place where poems reveal themselves to you. Ben Ramke hired me as a work study at the Denver Quarterly. And, you know, back then, like, there was no submittable. Everything came in envelopes. And so my job was to open all the envelopes and like read the cover letters and put them in one of two piles, one that goes straight to the editor's desk and one that kind of goes to the grad students who are doing the reading. But then I read every submission and, you know, was cutting out the stamps to save for collages for the journals that I was reading. You know, it's like crazy. And, you know, like kind of like finally getting a thumb a little bit on the pulse of what contemporary poetry looked like. And the Denver Quarterly was a great journal, like experimental but open to tradition. Like there could have been no better sort of tutelage for me than like sitting at that desk for 2 hours a day opening and reading poems. And then eventually like I got to like help make these decisions. Like Ben, in a very gentle way, I don't even, like so gentle I don't think I knew it was happening, was kind of folding me in.
Nice.
So I'm an undergrad, like meeting with the grad students, we're staying up until 2 a.m. like deciding what poems might get in and what might not. Don Revell was there at the time and had just left, and Ann Lauterbach came to teach, and Susan Howe came to teach. And I had gotten into a class of Susan Howe's, and the first day she showed us Chris Marker's film, Sans Soleil, that like blew my mind. And then she said that the class was a little bit too large and no undergrads could stay in it. And so I kind of slunk my head and walked away, only to find out that this other undergrad who was so, like, I think he was really obnoxious. He said he liked my poems because it was like looking at the whole world through a little straw.
Whoa.
Probably the best image he ever came up with.
There, you got your revenge. You got your revenge.
Anyway, he refused to leave Susan Howe's class. But Ann Lauterbach let me into the graduate poetry workshop and turned me on to some authors that really made a huge difference to me. I started reading Miwash. I started reading Oppen. I really fell hard in love with C.P. Kavafi. And, you know, so it's like I was suddenly like finding like these voices that made sense. And very early on, like, those poems were like I was writing towards voices I wanted to understand. Like I began to feel, though again, I would never have articulated at the time, that like what makes a great poet, in part a great poet, is that each one of those poems is like a particularly unique epistemology. Like they come to know the world in the way only the way in which they use language lets them know it. And part of like the real work I began to understand of what it is to read a poem at the level of that poet themselves is like you have to understand how that language lets you think. Like you're like allowed a permission into what a poem says the world might be. And the only way that you might like earn that permission, be worthy of that permission, is to write poems that are themselves experimenting with these linguistic shapes, these linguistic forms, these oddities of syntax, these possibilities within the very fiber of how phoneme and syllable lead to next phoneme and syllable. And so I began writing poems that were experiments in the way another poet thought, essentially, I think is what it was.
So do you feel like that's just fascinating to me. So do you feel like the only way to access that sort of epistemology of the poet's mind or of the poem itself is through writing? In other words, is it accessible to a reader? Maybe not in the same way, but I guess that was the question. Yeah, that's the question, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's a difference perhaps between a poet and a scholar who I think often look alike. Like some people think of me as a scholar, though I'm very, very far from one in my own mind. But it does seem to me that a poet has to step into the language that opens that world and learn how to see it through that language. And that an academic relationship to poetry is often a very different one, where one is stepping back from what the language is and kind of finding a framework, a set of parameters, a periphery from which to make a particular claim that you think that poems are making. And I have, like, zero interest in doing that. Like, I'm not interested in what I can say about a poem from outside the poem. I'm very interested about what a poem reveals about the nature of the world once you're within it.
Which means you have to sort of surrender to it, and okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Huh.
I love what you're talking about of performing the work on the page to understand the thinking, the thought process. I went from the workshop to doing like IT and web design, and I found that a lot of times when you're working with like a CMS or a backend or some sort of like database or any language, It's exact same thing. You're trying to learn how another person thought, and you're trying to you're basically trying to figure out their workflow through solving a problem. And it's never your own workflow. But once you get it, once you practice it, it almost becomes like a specific part of your brain for that specific task.
Yeah, that I feel like that's exactly it. That's how it, like the few poets I feel like I've become as intimate with as I possibly can. Like, you know, like you have to fall in love with the poets that are like, there's no, like, that's the cost of doing this. Like, you have to love them and suffer and the wonder of that love. But it feels like that to me, that like once you do that, you're like, you're within the language. And then it like, that's where there's not exactly an evolution of mind, but an entanglement of mind. Like, to like really read someone, like, I think literally changes the way neurons fire one into the other. Like, you walk into the world, you know, like, with new eyes to some degree. So, you know, like, I feel like, to go back to, you know, your question, like, I do think there's a good thing to do to teach students so that a poem can make sense, that they can understand it. But, like, the like, next level of reading is, like, that's not that poems make sense, i.e. they're understandable. It's, like, that poems are, like opening sense. Like you're more nervously alive to the world for the fact of having read a poem.
It's so fascinating, Dan, to hear you say everything that you've said. So, because it
truly,
it reminds me, I came to your work when I was at a very impressionable age as both a writer and a aspiring teacher. And I think you've always been someone to me that has served as a reminder that I don't have to do the work that everyone else is doing, and that it is possible to think about things differently and to take different paths and to follow the art. And I know from folks who had you as a teacher that you've been inspiring on that front. It always really impresses me when I think of Lauren being in the very first class you ever taught. So when you came to Iowa, you were entering a space. I imagine you did not have a ton of, we were talking about this last night as well, a ton of pedagogical training. They sort of said, go into this space. You have students like Lauren who are looking at you for answers in the way that you were just talking about sort of all you've learned over the last 31 years. When you think about speaking to young writers now, are there things that you would say to young Dan, a 19-year-old who comes into your room and says, you know, Mr. Beachy Quick, I want to be in a graduate level class and I believe that I love poetry. What do I do?
Something other than you can't be in this class because you're an undergrad.
Here's a poem I just wrote about a tractor and about thawing. But can you take me forward?
I love that image. Well, you know, what I do is I invite, you know, like, no matter the quality of the poem, like, if someone says that to me, I'll say, well, let's find a way to talk about it. And, you know, I do teach, but I also like take very seriously, like, for, you know, for students that I'm not, that I don't have in a class, like, if they want to talk about poems with me, then we'll just find time to do that. Like, I feel like that's one of the kind of ethics embedded in poetry writ large, is like, a class is a kind of accident, an MFA program is a kind of accident. Like, they're just ways that an age-old conversation is currently being housed, and that house will fall apart just like every house, you know, falls apart. But the importance of that conversation, no matter how, you know, like, it doesn't even matter, like, you know, like, how talent, like, it, like, if a poem, like, an undergrad gives me a poem that, like, knocks my sock off, it doesn't make me more excited than an undergrad giving me a terrible poem. It's like, the work feels the same to me. It's like drawing someone into the kind of intimate intensities of what it is to learn how to think towards poetry together. And I think that can happen in lots and lots of different ways. You know, what I would say back to myself, or like even thinking about my coming to Iowa and, you know, being so tormented by my own ambition, you know, like as I think so many, you know, poets in their 20s are, and a lot of poets like throughout their life, I think are. Like, I think it's important to understand that one of the courages that poetry can give us is a refusal of the economy that we're taught makes success look like a very, very particular kind of thing. And I really go out of my way to, you know, to let my students know that like the poetry itself forms the economy you're in, and that's an ancient Greek word, an oikonomos, like just the laws, the habits, how it is in the house it is that you are, you know, like poems are also kind of ethical and economic creatures, and there's as important lessons in like how poetry teaches us to value as there is in any other kind of meaning that poetry can take us to. So I really kind of stress, like, there's no greater happiness than being at work in a poem. And that labor is measured not as a kind of, like, it's not only worthwhile if it gets published, if you win prizes, if there's laurels. Like, if poetry is, like it matters to you, then being at work in poetry in ways that matter is the only measure of success, to what degree you can honestly and humbly be at work in words on the page so as to be more decently present in the world. That's all you need. And ideally, everything else, you know, is just like an accident. Like, I'm very stoic. You know, I've become stoic about such things. Like good things shouldn't, you know, lift you up more than bad things lift you down. Like, rejection, acceptance, like, all of these are kind of aside from what the genuine call to doing the work should give you, which is maybe only the gift of doing the work.
Wow. I really would love it if you would come and speak on the last day of the Young Writers Studio.
Yeah, they need to hear that.
That's the speech I've been trying to give for the past 20 years.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. It's so true.
What would 19-year-old Dan think of you now? Would he be proud?
19-year-old Dan was engaged to 18-year-old Christy. Danny Quick was engaged to Christy Beachy. And we're about to celebrate our, like, 30th anniversary.
Wow.
I think that kid would be very surprised that I've simply walked the path I set upon walking. Like, it's really weird, honestly. It kind of freaks me out a tiny bit. Like, I've really tried to love what I love, and just that's it, really. And I'm writing poems, and I have a couple kids, and somehow, you know, without one single pragmatic thought or plan in my, like, head, you know, have built a life around the things that have mattered most to me, and that it works is like a miracle to me, honestly.
It's probably the most immensely difficult thing you can do. Yeah.
Strange.
I think 19-year-old Dan DJ Quick would be pretty impressed.
DJ Quick.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. But thank you so much, Dan, for being on the pod, being our guest today, and for everything.
Yeah, thank you, friends.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.